be consistent throughout the whole scope of our revision. That is, as I indicated earlier, we're going to grade theft by way of felonies of the first, second, and third degrees. Maybe we should grade robbery by way of 1, 2, and 3 degrees, not 5, say, and burglary 1. See what I mean?
Oh, sure do. It seems to me that some types of crime might not have the same number of degrees as others, however, or the same degrees. Because sure, you're going to want to get at some violently assaulted conduct is tougher than a lot of other things.
Well, it might be well to defer any action on these gradings, Varsity, until we complete these other provisions.
Yeah. All right. We'll do that. I think we're really reaching the point of diminishing returns. But may I request that we just go over defenses?
Mm-hmm.
And if a person did not commit larceny if he acts under an honest claim of right, in that he's unaware that the property service is that of another. Discussion.
Where did you read from?
I'm on 1A on larceny defenses.
Yeah, oh. The services are not there.
That isn't in my...
Oh.
Oh, yeah, there it is.
Person doesn't fit larceny if he acts under an honest claim of right in that A, he's unaware that the property is that of another. Delete service because we're going to cover services elsewhere. Should we say is that of another or rightfully belongs to another? Maybe is that is better, I don't know.
Well, I understand is that.
Acceptable. Alright. Or he believes that he is entitled to the property involved, or he has a right to acquire or dispose of it as he does.
I would insert the word reasonably before it leaves.
This involves some self-help situation, doesn't it? I think this guy I work for owes me $100.
He reasonably believes that he's entitled to the property involved, or that he reasonably has a right to acquire.
I think that reasonably pulls over.
All right, or that he has a right to acquire or dispose of it as he does.
If you drop that second he, you would.
Reasonably believes that he is entitled to the property involved or has a right to acquire or dispose of it. Now, as he does, is that necessary?
To so this well, as he does.
No, he might have a reasonable right to acquire or dispose of it. Property, and he's all right as long as he doesn't
act
fashion.
He's going to
be honest. He isn't.
Are you sure you want to take out that second, that he?
No, not that.
No, just the he. Is what
or that.
Wait. Yeah. Read or.
Doesn't read
that. Or that.
Please, he's entitled to the property involved or has. That he. We delete that with that he, okay?
He believes what? He believes he's entitled to it?
Or has a right to it.
He reasonably believes he's entitled to it, or reasonably believes he has a right to acquire this property.
Okay. The burden of rejecting the claim of right is on the defendant, but this does not shift the burden of proof. Does this come from New York?
Yes.
Now, that's from the Michigan draft. And it seemed to me to be pretty good language and would be in accord with our case law in this state.
I think it is, too.
Huh?
I think it is.
I do, too.
I think that it will require the defendant to do more than say just plead this. He's going to have to put something into the case.
Right.
But then we go ahead and spell out that even though he's required to put it into the case, that this doesn't shift the burden to him.
Well, he doesn't, of course, plead.
He doesn't plead not guilty, and then in his opening statement,
It's like raising an alibi defense or an insanity.
Well, if it's like raising an insanity defense, are you going to make him give the district attorney notice at the time of arraignment unless the court lets him do it later?
It occurs to me that this is going to be a subject for a general section, isn't it? We're going to get into insanity, we're going to get into alibi, we're probably going to get into this specifically with respect to more liberal discovery procedures.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with what you're saying here, but I don't think that this is the kind of thing that we need to put into a notice pleading proposition. It seems to me that we can do it just like we do this general kind of thing now. It's just the defendant puts in some evidence, his attorney gets up and mentions in his opening statement. I expect to prove.
I think I agree with that. I think insanity is a thing all to itself.
Okay.
Because that requires some medical expert witness.
Okay. Well, what I'm simply suggesting is that whether it is or isn't, it's not properly subject to consideration here. I agree with this. I think it's fine. Two, in any prosecution for larceny by extortion committed by hostilities in the victim, a fear that he or another person would be charged with the crime, it is an affirmative defense that the defendant reasonably believed the threatened charge to be true, and that his sole purpose was to compel or induce the victim to take reasonable action to make good the wrong which was the subject of the threatened charge. Michigan.
Yes. No, wait a minute. I'll take that back. That's not from Michigan. That's from New York. The Michigan draft may be similar to that, I believe it is, but I followed the New York draft on this particular defense because I followed their draft on the short.
Does the Model Penal Code have a section on defenses?
Yeah,
I can't find it. Maybe it had, but I haven't found it.
Yeah, on page 165 of your proposed official draft.
Oh, claim of right.
Theft from spouse. And then, under section 223.4 on page 169, theft by extortion is an affirmative defense to B, C, or D.
Okay, now does this affirmative defense more properly belong in the extortion section? No, I don't think so.
Well, I thought that as long as it was a defense, and we had a section on defense.
Put them all together.
They should all be together.
Everything, sir.
Any problem with two?
All right.
Okay, Representative Elder.
On two?
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. So we have three.
You can't. A man can't steal from his wife.
It's an affirmative defense that the property involved is that of the defendant's spouse unless the parties were not living together as man and wife and were living in separate abodes at the time of the alleged theft.
It seems to me that's somewhat inconsistent with the married woman's statutes.
Well,
Yeah, but the state of the law around the country generally has been that in spite of the married women statutes, that the men and wife can't steal from each other. There hadn't been much...
Jointly owned property.
Well, no, I think any kind of property. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any authority in Oregon on it.
No, there isn't any Oregon authority, but...
I got a divorce case, and the husband who I represent went out and took the stereo out of the house the other day. He's living in Portland, she's living in Hillsborough.
Well, of course, this has been living in separate abodes. But
And they were living in separate abodes.
Yeah, but then he could be guilty under this thing.
Yeah.
But I think even though they're living under the same roof, one's in the bedroom on one end of the house and the other one's on the other end, that the guy shouldn't be able to steal his wife's stuff.
Well, you like, you're for the woman.
Yeah.
Oh, I...
do something like this, that in order to preserve marital harmony, if the stuff is available to both, it shouldn't be a larceny situation. This is a spat. We're not going to trouble the police with it. We're going to make them go to the divorce court. But the Model Penal Code went through a long history of wrangling with it. They had a complicated section where they said, if it's over $500, it'll be larceny. If the party is about to separate, it'll be larceny. But this gives the... This
yeah.
changes the law a little bit in the direction of allowing it to be larceny, but not very much. They've got
not
to be split
much.
Up.
I don't agree with making them go to the divorce court if they don't want to go to the divorce court in order to enforce their rights.
Oh.
The divorce court's the last place to go.
But see, what you get into, though, there is trying to determine ownership when they're both living in the same house and there's property that they've been sharing together.
Well, that gives the district attorney a good idea for saying that you haven't got a case.
Now, on these Married Women's Property Acts, there are cases that have held that because of the Married Women's Property Act, she should be protected under the criminal law.
Yes, of course, there are some. There
I mean, there's a split, and
there
aren't a lot of cases on it. But
well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not selling this, but I think maybe we should discuss the fact that that what I think is the latest Model Penal Code thing on the thing is a little tougher in creating the crime rather than. It says it is no defense that theft was from the act or spouse, except that misappropriation of household and personal effects or other property normally accessible to both spouses is theft only if it occurs after the parties have ceased living together. But if I today steal from my wife about $5,000 that she's got hidden someplace, this is not household and personal effects or other property normally accessible to me, and under the Model Penal Code, I would be guilty of larceny. That would be tougher on me than your proposal.
Yeah.
And Bruce suggests he wants to be a little tougher than the proposed draft.
Well, what I'm thinking about is a woman comes in and to the office and says, what the devil am I going to do? My husband keeps taking my stuff. I don't want a divorce. I would tell her, oh, you can't do a darn thing. Unless you want to go get a divorce. And I don't believe in divorce. I won't get a divorce. And what am I going to do? Well, there's nothing you can do.
Get her a restraining order.
She doesn't want to leave her husband?
No, she doesn't want to leave him. She wants to have that house stay as it is. But she can't get along with having him walk off with all of his crap.
I don't see how prosecuting this husband that she doesn't want to leave and whom she's living with in the same house, prosecuting him for larceny, is going to do anything for anybody.
Because when she comes in and the DA says, okay, Mrs. McGooslin, I'll let you sign this complaint, but you realize that if you sign the complaint, you're going to have to testify against him in court, and Judge Murchison might give him 5 years in the joint.
Well,
he's going to say,
it isn't worth it, probably, but it's better than having to say to her that there's not a darn thing you can do about it. Go get a divorce.
Well, you.
Why doesn't she want her husband to have access to this property? If they're still living together, man and wife,
they're not living together very happily.
I
can think of one of this, and that was the case of the husband who was departing with the heirloom silver.
Mm-hmm.
Piece by piece, proceeded to sell it. She wasn't looking at it. I mean, she was looking at it. I think she was breaking it up or something. She was pretty unhappy about the loss of her heirloom silver, but she wasn't ready to move out. She just wanted to be able to stop him from restraining him. And if he took one more piece of it
She could get a restraining order against him.
She could make, but not in the marriage. just the way the judges act out here. He said, if you want to bring a marital action, okay, we'll give you a restraining order. But no restraining order in the abstract.
I don't know. It seems to me that if you're going to allow prosecutions of this sort where parties are continuing to live together, you're putting the prosecutor in an impossible position. I think from the standpoint of proof, one thing, who this property belongs to would be almost impossible.
You have that problem. The prosecutor has that problem in lots of situations, and he takes care of it by saying you haven't had sufficient evidence. I can't prosecute.
You're saying here that it's an affirmative defense, the property involved is that of the defendant's spouse, unless the parties were not living together as man and wife and were living in separate abodes at the time of the alleged theft. Now, in my case, my client that went out there and took the stereo, even though it belonged to him, she had it in her house, she could prosecute it.
Well, yeah, I think you have a question who it belonged to, who actually owned the property. That would still be, I mean, if it was his property, even though it was kept in her house, I don't think he'd be guilty of larceny.
We don't have any such affirmative defense in present Oregon law, do we?
No, I think it's better to leave it as it is.
I mean, not put anything in,
yeah,
but leave it out.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, not cover the
If you do that, then of course, you don't have any protection at all for the spouse under present Oregon law, really.
Except for grabs what the Supreme Court might decide in the proper case.
I'm not sure about that. Are you?
Well, there aren't any cases on it.
I agree with that, probably.
I think, as I pointed out in my comment on this, I think that maybe the reason there aren't any cases is because prosecutors are pretty reluctant to get into this kind of situation, even though they're separated now. If they're still husband and wife, they're just not going to take it to court. Again,
I think if they're separated, they ought to deal with it.
Well, and that's what I was trying to do in this draft, take a middle road to approach, which is... Now, this comes from the Illinois Code, this approach. It seemed to me it was more reasonable because it didn't require them to be divorced, but it required them to be living apart. And if they're living in separate abodes and their property is segregated, it seemed to me there's no good reason why this wife or this husband shouldn't be protected from the spouse. But if they're still living with as husband and wife, I think that...
no matter what it is.
If they're willing to tolerate this type of conduct from their spouse, I don't think it belongs in criminal court. I mean, if a wife's willing to put up with this, not that we should encourage divorces, but I don't see where prosecuting a husband for larceny is particularly going to enhance the marital relationship.
Depends on the heading, for better or for worse.
But if they're living apart, she's got her stuff, and he has his stuff, and he keeps coming over and taking things that he shouldn't, then I think that she ought to be protected, or vice versa. But I don't agree with this idea of this fiction.
I believe that, even though it's pretty.
You know, this fiction that they're one person and they can't steal from each other.
Oh, yeah, that's kind of larky.
Yeah.
From a straight day-to-day operation of a good police department, can deal with each other, and you're going to be deluged with marital problems in addition to the ones you're already deluged with, aren't you?
You can't really solve the husband and wife fights with present law. Because of the practical matter that every time the DA issues a complaint or the judge signs a complaint, the wife dismisses it the following morning.
I see that if we put this in as every doggone separation that you have where there's a divorce brewing, the wife's going to be down in the DA's office saying, that so-and-so came over and stole my what's-it-called. I want to complain.
It becomes a lot of weapons in the whole action.
Well, my inclination is to leave it out. Let me say this, though. There is a trend toward this.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe rather than having the subcommittee make an arbitrary decision, I mean, we're in the business of making decisions. I think we ought to take it out, but I think it ought to be brought up to the full committee and explained to them now, and let them make the decision.
Reserve 4 hours to come. Now, of the ones I looked at, New York's the only one that I didn't find any provision to cover this type of plan. While Winnipeg has it, the Michigan draft has a comparable provision, the Illinois draft has it. So I think they're all moving in this direction of affording the spouse more protection. Just a question how far you want to go.
How about leaving it in the draft and putting it in brackets with a note that the subcommittee recommends deletion of?
Well, I think there ought to be some protection for the spouses when they're living separately, really. Because I don't think that's... I think once that they've made a clean separation, no matter whether they're divorced or what, but they're living separately and they've divided their stuff, certainly
there
can be larceny and they can... I don't know, maybe they ought to require that there be a burglary, I don't know.
Under present law, there is this protection, really, isn't
there?
Yeah,
we're making new law.
I know, but if we just omit it, the grieved spouse can avail himself of...
Yeah, the worst.
Well, not necessarily. Come in and said, I'm living over here, and probably I'm separated from still some of my property. Would he...
I think he could.
He could.
He could now, you think?
I think. Why don't we say that the subcommittee recommends 2-1 deletion?
Okay.
I'm in favor of deleting it.
I want to dissent on it because I think there's a reason for that we should have this.
And this will give you an opportunity to review it to the subcommittee. Maybe between now and maybe we'll change our minds.
Yeah, I looked at it this way, that there are no Oregon cases on this, so we would have to assume that the common law would apply here. And under the common law, there isn't any theft between spouses. That's
because there's one marriage.
That's my reason.
No, but I think that the general common law, even after the marriage under statutes would be put it away, was still that there was no theft between spouses. I say that based on just a law teacher's quick survey of the annotation.
Yeah, CJS says there's a split of authority.
Yeah, there's a split of authority.
But
it's not so positive that I think you could get the Supreme Court to rule on that.
And of course, we do have some statutes that are of the nature of married women's property statutes that certainly expand the property rights of females.
It seems to me that there is a point where they ought to stop filtering from each other.
And sometimes it's in the pilfering situation. A lot of people go try to deal with a situation where a guy marries a gal with the idea of taking her for about $10,000.
Right.
And then within 6 months he cleans her out and goes to Australia. But this kind of thing ought to be highly criminal.
Well,
it's
that's
kind of complicated.
Very unsporting way to look at it. Alright. Well, now...
the shotgun might be the first.
I've had a few of those cases too.
I thought you were against self-help.
I recommend that.
We're going to proscribe firearms. Now, we are through the draft too, and there's, I think probably at our next meeting, we're going to be able to pass this out. We're through the fences, and we're up to unauthorized use of motor vehicles and bad checks. Now, I don't know when Tony is scheduled the next committee meeting, but...
The whole commission?
Yeah.
There has been one scheduled.
But will it be too much of an imposition on the members if we schedule a subcommittee meeting 2 weeks hence? We schedule it in Portland if your offer is still open.
Sure is.
And devote that meeting to review what we've done today, motor vehicles and checks. Now, is that going to push it on?
Okay.
Oh, no, I think we can be ready.
Six.
The 6th?
Mm-hmm.
6th of April.
Or did you say that?
Okay. Okay. 6th of April, the rings are doing.
The only thing is that we ran into this problem with this meeting, Chairman, and I mentioned Mr. Chandler has brought up the question of giving more notice of upcoming meetings. And it's, of course, the notice went out to his office arrived when he was gone, and so he didn't get as much notice as we hoped. But he, in any event, he had a prior commitment. He couldn't be here today. So and it's unfortunate because it's the second subcommittee meeting he's been unable to attend. And I wonder if a 2-week advance notice is going to be sufficient to avoid this kind of problem.
Could you?
Is going to be here, but in other words, would you want to make this a tentative sort of thing, say tentatively set it for the 6th of April on that, and see what the reaction is?
Yeah, ma'am.
Yeah.
All right.
Not as soon thereafter as possible, because we need to get with this, I think.
We need to, and I think we're on top of this, and we should see it through before we get moved with the full committee meeting where a lot of other things are coming in on top of us. But could you call Bob Chandler Monday, see if he's going to be available, double check with us as far as our calendars are concerned, and with yourselves?
No question on my part,
would you be able to attend? Would you be able to attend such a meeting?
You'll be available, Professor Arthur? All right, let's tentatively set it 2 weeks hence and reconfirm this first week. I think we can get into checks at that time in motor vehicles, don't you?
Well, now, of course, checks. I was under the impression that we had decided this morning to take checks out of the larceny statute, or have we decided that?
Well, I guess we have.
If we do that, then, of course, we can defer that until we get to fraudulent practices. But we should consider a section in here on theft by deception.
All right. That'll be a big section. And we should consider motor vehicles. And what about gradient offenses? Are we going to defer that?
I would think that it would make sense to defer that until the end of this, of our assignment.
Right.
Make them fit all of our work.
It's a full committee job. Mm-hmm.
All right. I have this suggestion from a mechanical standpoint. Are you members going to take, everybody going to, do you take your drafts with you?
Mm-hmm. No
problem. I think maybe if every one of these books in the future was numbered, had the pages were numbered, so when any of us are referring back to something that appears in a different volume and arena, we could just say page 5 in volume 2, rather than, you know. And then a second thing, in the next proposed draft, is it possible to make them, to prepare it with margins, and in the margins on the draft, put the citations to the present oriented law.
Either they have, or parenthetically, right at the end of the paragraph,
yeah,
or something that we're saying that that would be assistance.
Would that be helpful?
Yeah, the way we've been doing it was in accordance with the this overall approach we decided to take, and we were just experimenting really to learn and see what's going to be workable. But
when we're discussing a specific subsection, if we could look right there in the margin and see that, you know,
we didn't have to look up.
We didn't have to look up in the front.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Embarrassing.
Might be embarrassing.
I was going to recall some of the actions that took place in the Judiciary Committee when you were chairman concerning these same questions. Realizing your brethren here, I think that I will defer.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
Coffee up here on Graham.
Mr. Chairman,
I'm going
to
set that verdict aside on that case, didn't he?
Yeah. Well, I heard that he said that he would if there was a verdict.
Why do they send a case like that to the jury? I heard he said before it went to the jury that he was going to do it.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
Why do they do that?
Well, so that the plaintiff can appeal, and in the event of a reversal, it doesn't have to be retried. I just reinstate the verdict.
Well, that's right. That's right. Why don't we call a meeting to order and very briefly, Don, go ahead and review what we did in the last meeting.
All right. Now, with respect to the minutes, Mr. Chairman, you want to?
I think it's in order to dispense with reading of the minutes, but I wish you summarize. We're going to be reviewing preliminary draft number 3 of criminal mischief, and I think it would, since it's been a month since we last met, I think it'd help the committee to more or less temper us, get us back in the temper of things. If you would just briefly review what we did the last meeting, and particularly why we're going to be back on criminal mischief.
Well, theft of services was approved with some amendment. We also approved criminal trespass, burglary, and possession of burglar's tools. Portions of the minutes of the meeting of May 27th relating to unfinished business, criminal tampering and criminal mischief appear on page 5. Through what appears there. Should then I explain the draft on criminal tampering, which was before our last meeting as preliminary draft number 2, conformed to the amendments adopted the last subcommittee meeting. And we also had preliminary draft number 2A, which was drafted as a result of the committee's request that the section on criminal tampering be drafted to see if it would fit in with criminal mischief just as one section or as one article. And criminal mischief in the second degree in that draft was identical to the preliminary draft number 2, only in that draft we referred to it as criminal tampering. And then we had two sections in preliminary draft number 2A, criminal mischief in the first degree dealt with the person who caused damage or intended to cause damage to property of another, as opposed to the intent to cause substantial inconvenience, which was the intent that would be requisite for committing a crime of criminal tampering. Second degree mischief was embraced in first degree mischief if there was actual damage to property. We discussed whether or not another degree should be included, which would cover malicious and wanton destruction of personal property similar to ORS 164-900. And I gave my opinion that criminal mischief in the first degree would cover that type of conduct that was included in that ORS section. And also referred to ORS 161010 sub 6, which defined the term wantonly, which was very close to the subsection 2, our draft criminal mischief in the first degree. And there was approval of the joint of those two sections. Then with respect to preliminary draft number 2A, which is really the one that leads us to the draft we have before today, there was discussion whether or not we should have a draft that would have three degrees of the crime. One, similar to Michigan draft, which and also the New York draft, which makes a higher degree for damage through the use of explosives. And we also discussed at that time whether or not the use of explosives would be covered under arson. And I expressed my opinion that I thought that would be a logical place for the crime to be placed as far as our drafting is concerned. But after further discussion, as the minutes indicate, Chairman Burns asked Mr. Follett to give more study of the problems the committee had discussed with respect to the proposed criminal mischief statute and to either prepare a revised draft encompassing the crime by use of explosives in the criminal mischief sections or to cover that subject in the arson draft. Well, to summarize, I think that we can have provisions relating to the use of explosives in both the criminal mischief sections and in the upcoming arson draft, because the type of intent that's involved and the type of damage that's involved are not necessarily the same. Particularly with respect to the arson drafts and the arson statutes, New York and Michigan both have provisions under their arson sections prohibiting the use of explosives, either intentional or reckless use of explosives that causes damage to a building. The kind of language that's used is intentional and reckless damage to a building by causing an explosion, rather than the word or the terminology, the use of an explosive, by causing an explosion. But they're related specifically to damaged buildings. Now, so as far as criminal mischief is concerned, I don't think it would necessarily be duplication or overlap. I think that if the subcommittee saw fit to adopt a draft on criminal mischief which prohibited criminal mischief by means of an explosive, assuming that we do have a section in the arson, that those two articles would complement each other
Has your research assistant researched into the chapter on firearms to see if there are any present overlapping duplicating statutes there relating to the use of explosives so that we possibly later on be confronted with a third area in which explosions are a subject of criminal proscription?
The memorandum that I have received on that deals with, it appears to pick up and consider any of the statutes that deal with explosives in any manner. Some of the statutes in the 400 series, for example, which are not criminal statutes, but which relate to the use of explosives and that type of thing. We're going to take a look at those. I haven't had an opportunity yet to really study the material on arson to that extent, but we are going to, I'm sure that the material has research that includes examination of those.
So you're saying the constitutional problem, I don't think, will put me at a problem. I asked, for example, giving consideration to the use of explosives as far as mischief is concerned, and also as far as arson is concerned.
I don't think that there even have a perfect problem here because we're talking about different elements, really. each of these crimes. As I said, I haven't looked at it, really examined the question of the arson in the draft to that extent. I really don't think that we would have a difficult same conduct might constitute two different crimes. As long as it's
as long as there's standards written into the statute and doesn't cover or constitute.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a question of leaving it solely to the discretion of the prosecutor. And it wouldn't be a question of leaving it solely to the discretion of the grand jury, for example, to determine whether it's going to be a misdemeanor or a
felon.
Lynn,
does that then bring us up, Don, to where we are today?
Well, I hope so. I think that should bring us logically to consideration of this preliminary draft number 3 on criminal history.
Now, do we have a commentary with that?
Well, no, you don't have any commentary because I intended to go through it, plus the fact that all I have done here really is proceed as directed by the subcommittee to see if we can.
There was originally a commentary,
yeah,
wasn't there?
Yeah, there was commentary with the last draft.
All right. Let's. And that would be commentary would be in booklet number 8.
Is that right, Mildred?
It's also in your notebook there.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Orange.
Okay, let's go. Might say, for the benefit of the committee subcommittee members, that Don advised me that he went before the emergency board last week and they granted us $27,000 to get a little bit more help, and apparently the other two subcommittees, which haven't been operating yet, haven't been meeting because they haven't had the research done preliminary to their meeting, are starting in forthwith. So things seem to be moving along.
I might add to that. The approval of that request raises our appropriation for the biennium to approximately $65,000.
What's the goal now with that much money? What do you think you could finish and have ready by January?
Yeah, I prepared a projection which I submitted to the emergency board. In recess, I can get a copy of that. Over that, so you can see how we've tentatively planned what articles we hope to have finished by the end of this year, which will be included within our report to the next session.
Okay.
I can tell you roughly it would include all of the articles of crime against property. Preliminary provisions, the first five, the counterparts to the first five articles in the Model Penal Code.
It's possible to submit an omnibus bill that crimes against property in the legislature without running into any problems. There are some statutes, obviously, that you couldn't eliminate unless you did the whole thing, right?
Well,
I think we
some
have
crimes against property will also be crimes against people, right?
I think we have to make a policy judgment on the full commission as to whether or not we should submit something piecemeal to the 69 legislature or whether we should proceed comprehensive.
Yeah, well, as a matter of fact, the commission has already made that determination, if I'm not mistaken, at our meeting in January.
To do it in 71.
Yeah, but the. Inasmuch as we were directed to submit a report to the 69 legislature, that we would show them by including in our report the drafts that had been tentatively approved to that point to show them what our progress was. But we were not going to submit anything in bill form to for action by the legislature. And then wait, and then submit it all in similar to what you see on this Michigan proposal.
Okay, let's get into criminal mischief if there are any questions.
Now, okay, referring now to preliminary draft number 3, June 1968, criminal mischief, section 1, criminal mischief in the third degree. A person commits the crime of criminal mischief in the third degree if, with intent to cause substantial inconvenience to the owner or to another person, and having no right to do so, nor reasonable ground to believe that he has such right, he tampers or interferes with property of another. Now, this is substantially the same language that appeared in draft number 2 and 2A. This is really criminal tampering is what we're talking about here, and carries over the idea that was approved by the last subcommittee, the idea of incorporating criminal tampering into a criminal mischief statute, although we don't call it criminal tampering as such. I made some minor grammatical changes in structuring this from as opposed to preliminary draft number 2A. The main reason was so that it would be consistent with the structure of the column sections of sections 2 and 3. See, the language we used in 2A said, a person commits criminal mischief in the second degree if he tampers or interferes with property of another with intent to cause substantial inconvenience to the owner or to another person without having any right to do so or any reasonable ground to believe that he has such right. So the substance is the same, the form is a little different. Now section 2 encompasses what we previously called first degree under preliminary draft number 2A, which if he violates section 1, he commits tampering, and as a result of that, he damages property. That's the same as we had in preliminary draft number 2A, except that I have, in thinking about some of the questions that particularly Mr. Spaulding brought up last time, whether or not we should have the same kind of prohibition, the same kind of penalty involving conduct that on the one hand was the result of just an intent to cause substantial inconvenience to someone and not an intent to damage the property, having that punishable the same as conduct in which there's an intentional damage to the property of another. And I thought perhaps this might be a good way to distinguish between the two, and that is that find that if he violates section 1, which would be criminal tampering, and damages property in an amount exceeding $100, that would help to distinguish that type of conduct from the intentional damage.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's criminal mischief and there's minor damage of the value of less than $100, it would still be criminal mischief in the third degree. But even though he had no intent to damage the property, if the value damage exceeds $100, and I've arbitrarily picked $100, feeling that it's likely that this will be a point of departure in our theft statutes between
petty
and grand, or whatever we decide to call it. But the traditional form of distinguishing between a minor type of damage to property or a minor theft as opposed to one that's more serious because of the value of property. Then under section 2, sub 2, if he had, having no right to do so, nor reasonable ground to believe he has such right, if he intentionally damages property of another, and here the value would not be an element, he intentionally damages property of another, or if he recklessly damages property of another in an amount exceeding $100. Here again, that would was no intent to damage the property, that it would not get into criminal mischief in the second degree unless there's value in the end more than $100.
Okay, question. We're making a, Don, would you prefer to go through 1, 2, and 3 before we open it up to questions? Would you rather get into 3 and get the whole composite picture?
I think it might be easier
all right.
For
all right.
To get how they all fit together.
Okay.
Now, Section 3, well, I might add that Section 2 includes some of the language out of the New York Penal Law. Section 14500. This grading according to value and damages. Also, this provision of recklessness. Now, under Section 3, criminal mischief in the first degree provides a person commits a crime of criminal mischief in the first degree if with intent to damage property. And having no right to do so, nor reasonable ground to believe that he has such right, he damages property of another. And here, this is this follows the New York draft, and also follows the Michigan approach. Now, Michigan uses $1,000, New York uses $1,500. The only difference in their two statutes. And this punishes an intentional damage in excess of $1,000, or by means of an explosive. So, if you have an intent to damage. And by whatever means you do it, the value of the damage exceeds $1,000, it would be criminal mischief in the first degree. Or if you have an intent to damage and you do it with an explosive, regardless of the amount of damage, it would still be criminal mischief in the first degree. As far as an unintentional or reckless use of explosives, that would be covered under our Section 2, under the reckless damage, if it exceeds $1,000.
Is the word explosive, is that all inclusive? I understand you can have it imported now. And is that sufficiently in the hands of ordinary people that we need to worry about it?
Well, we talked about that, I think,
we did.
A little bit
yeah,
the last
we did
meeting.
Talk about
we
it.
We covered one of the four sections.
And we gave some consideration, as I recollect, to whether or not explosives should be defined.
I think we decided it wasn't necessary.
We decided it wasn't necessary.
We could go back.
This is a question in my mind last time that I didn't ask.
We can refer back to the minutes of the last meeting.
Or maybe I just thought.
I think you discussed it kind of the same thing as well.
I think it was in connection with burglary. Yeah,
well, that's where the question came up in my mind.
I specifically recall one comment made whether the use of a firearm is technically.
Oh, yeah.
On page 9, Mr. Spaulding. Ask if it would be advisable to further describe explosives in sub 1A. Mr. Pallette replied that the subsection was aimed particularly at safe crackers and pointed out that 164.260 said nitro, dynamite, gunpowder, or other high explosives. He expressed the view that the use of explosive without a qualifying adjective would not narrow the statute. That's on page 9,
You think explosives should be defined then?
Well, the only experience I ever had running into this was when they endeavored to introduce a bill some time ago to regulate the abandonment of caps left out where, you've been doing some clearing or something and injury resulted from the caps. And I know the question then came up as to whether or not strictly within the definition of explosive was a cap included, and so forth. So in that bill, as I remember, we did endeavor to define it in terms of including but not limited to, because because the question, and along in that discussion, several other types of material. The question, well, would it include this, would it include that? And the decision there made was that it might be the wiser course to endeavor to at least give a hint of what kind of thing you're talking about by including type definition. But, I mean, I had the same question in my mind, Mr. Eller, if they were looking at the draft.
Device and it can make an implosion.
Can you make a what?
Make an implosion. Instead of expanding it, it pulls things in, it pulls things together, and that creates a coil of
pressure. Yeah. And it increases the heat, and therefore it explodes. That's how diesel engine works.
From a drafting standpoint, Kathleen, would possibly explosive be a definition of explosive be the type of thing that would be put in the general articles?
I would assume so, because you were spoken already of burglary committed with the use of explosives. I'm assuming the definition is pretty much the same.
I would think that the term explosive is one that the clerkman didn't say is a ordinary word.
It's pretty self-explanatory.
Yeah, and you try to explain it and you're going right above it.
That's a problem with some of these words and terms that we do use. You may create more problems than you solve by trying to over-define it.
Yeah, we all know what explosive means, and what we're talking about is causing something to do damage by chemical reaction or whatever makes things pop.
Explosives are defined in two different places in the code already. One relating to commercial fishing, about not putting explosives in the water, and the other one relating to the tort liability and responsibility of persons for blasting operations. I don't know offhand what those two definitions are, but we do have two
definitions, and we have this other definition that I alluded to from the minutes. Let me back up. You've completed the three sections. And direct your attention to section 2, sub 1, and call your attention to the fact that if, bear in mind that this is something that we discussed rather extensively last meeting, but if we adopt this, putting a dollar tag on a degree of criminal mischief, we're making a departure, we're making a new policy decision and departing from the present code, because historically the malicious destruction statute was framed in terms of the degree of wantonness or maliciousness with which the act was committed, rather than in terms of the dollars and cents of the damage. Now, I recall in context a case I prosecuted once where a guy went into a restaurant out in East Multnomah County and he ripped a telephone off a wall and just tore the place up. Highly questionable whether the damage that he wrought on the place was over $100, but he was prosecuted and convicted of malicious destruction. And he should have been, in my judgment. Whereas, when you get down here as a corollary of this, where he talked about recklessly damaging property of another, exceeding $100, what if I have a car wreck? I'm guilty of reckless driving. And I run into your fence or something. And you come into the DA's office, say it cost me $600 to put up this fence, and that damn teenager decided for reckless driving, I want to complain against him.
He had no reasonable ground to believe that he had arrested and knock your fence over.
Right. None. So, I'm talking really about two different things, but I bring these two examples up to stimulate your thoughts and to hear what you have to say about this.
You took the question right out of my mouth about this reckless thing business. I didn't know whether it was a good question or a facetious question.
Now, I really, if you look at the commentaries, it is true that the Model Penal Code employs the use of the word reckless.
Reckless in your house, that means one thing, and this means another, doesn't it?
Somewhat the same.
Now. New York and Michigan, both, and the Model Penal Code also, talk about conduct that is reckless. And the Model Penal Code, and I might add, I'm anticipating that terms such as reckless or recklessly and negligence and negligently and these other terms that would be used generally throughout the complete draft will be defined. I mean, obviously they're going to have to be defined. Or similar terms, assuming that those particular words aren't adopted by the committee. But a term or a word that connotes that the same, essentially the same kind of conduct as recklessness. But recklessly is defined in the Model Penal Code as a person acts recklessly with respect to a material element of an offense when he consciously disregards a substantial and unjustifiable risk that the material element exists or will result from his conduct. The risk must be of such a nature and degree that, considering the nature and purpose of the actor's conduct and the circumstances known to him, his disregard involves a gross deviation from the standard of conduct of the law-abiding person who observed in the actor's situation. I don't know whether that really clears it up or not. But...
I come up with a question, question about this reckless driving, and that is, are you saying you don't think that the person who results in damages someone's fence as a result of reckless conduct should not be...
I'm saying that a person who does this should not be prosecuted. That's what I'm saying.
Under the statute, maybe for reckless driving.
He should be prosecuted for reckless driving, but he shouldn't be prosecuted for criminal mischief. That's what I'm saying.
I tend to agree with that.
What about if he takes his car and drives over the curb and across the courthouse lawn?
If he does it intentionally, then... and I have no problem whatsoever with respect to the language, the parenthetical expression in Section 3, where you say, with intent to damage property. I have no compunction there. And that would apply if I get mad at my wife and drive through her petunia, or, you know, drive across a courthouse lawn and get mad at somebody. But if I'm engaged in act of reckless driving. I give you an example. I have a defense case on a wrongful death where the district attorney's office in Portland spent 4 months to make a negligent homicide case against this boy, and they weren't able to do it. I have no doubt in my mind that if we had a criminal mischief provision here, they'd charge him criminally with criminal mischief. I say they should prosecute him for the driving offense, and then let that be put to the test in the civil action. But without the safeguard of intent to damage, I think DAs are going to be plagued with this.
The question I have in my mind is, I think there's a little bit of negligence in every accident by both parties. And are they It hasn't been done in the past, but under this, would they be chargeable under this statute?
Would this
recklessness be now become something that could be charged under the statute? That's what worries me a little bit, Don. I know what you're getting at. It's a good thought. Somewhere or other, we'll be able to make the distinction here. Because people who commit, who are involved in an automobile accident and are negligent, ordinary negligence, you know, they just really don't mean to do anything wrong, but they've done it.
That doesn't mean reckless, though.
Yeah, I don't think it would either.
No.
Ordinary negligence.
I'm sure. I know you say you don't think, but.
Ordinary negligence doesn't mean reckless.
No. Not in my book, anyway.
Recklessness really is closer to our present definition of.
Wantonness.
Yeah, or gross negligence.
Gross negligence, yeah. If you're talking about gross negligence, then okay.
Because.
A conscious.
Disregard
of the rights of others, and without regard of damage that might result.
Well, then, if this compared to gross negligence, then I can see a problem.
But see, what the Model Penal Code attempts to do in their definition is by going to terms such as recklessness, they're trying to get away from all these confusing words such as maliciousness and wantonness and gross negligence, and terms that have been used through the years and have about as many different interpretations as there are cases on that subject. Well, you know how much difficulty the courts had with gross negligence, for example.
I mean, on the negligent homicide statute. Well, I think there's just a recent decision in the advance sheets on that again. Well, that's right. There isn't any doubt about it.
That's what that means, and I don't see a problem with it.
Well, would you agree that if this means a well, wait a minute, strike that. Is it your thought, Don, that you're just more or less supplanting wanton and malicious as we have in 164.900 with reckless here?
Yeah, with reckless and to an extent intentional damage, because I think the malicious destruction statute, as you look to the definition of wanton, they're certainly not just talking about negligent conduct there.
Well, you have.
They're actually talking about a higher degree of culpability than that.
But if you mean to an extent intentional, you already have a sub A intentional. Now you say reckless.
You have an intention to lay damage in the property in any amount. Yeah, they have the intent, but recklessly and not intentionally, you've got to do $100 for the damage.
Yeah. Now, I might pay your attention to what the New York congressmen say about this. Now, they refer to their section 14500, which I mentioned earlier. Now, they call it criminal mischief in the third degree. And the reason, of course, and the difference in the degrees is that what we're trying to do in our draft is we're trying to bring in criminal tampering. See, they have separate provisions for tampering. And we were trying to incorporate the two under one article. But they talk about criminal mischief in the third degree if he intentionally damages property of another person or recklessly damages property of another person in an amount exceeding $250. Of course, the monetary provisions throughout the New York Code are higher than we're traditionally used to, I think. But
that's just identical ours, except that you're saying 100 rather than 250.
That's right.
And Michigan says, person commits a crime, criminal mischief in the third degree, if having no right to do so or reasonable ground to believe that he has such a right, he intentionally or recklessly damages property of any value not exceeding 250. So ours is really stronger than Michigan's because we say if it's intentional.
Don't have to prove damage. The amount of damage.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
one could read that Michigan one that the $250 relates to the value of the property itself and not the value of the damages resulting from the action. I'm sure that's not what they mean.
That's right. All right. Okay. Well, I wanted to bring it up, and as we discuss it, I find nothing repugnant about it at this time, although I...
No, they give an example. It says the culpability concept prescribed in Subdivision 2, quote, recklessly. In brief, must be shown that the defendant was aware of and consciously disregarded a substantial risk that property damage in excess of $250 would occur. Thus, where the defendant is pitching a baseball to the catcher whom he knows is inexperienced and who is standing in front of a large plate glass window, it can be concluded that the defendant is acting, quote, recklessly, unquote. As originally enacted, Section 145 equated reckless conduct with intentional conduct. This introduced an imbalance which the 1967 amendment to this section cured by limiting criminal liability for reckless conduct to cases where the property damage exceeds $250. I personally think that that's a better approach than Michigan's. I think that, that there should be a distinction between intentional conduct and reckless conduct.
I do.
I agree.
That's why I prefer this New York approach to it. And they apparently tried it the other way, and they didn't like it, so they amended it. They amended their 1965 version of this.
Well, let me just think out loud. I'm probably behind the rest of you. But if we go to this three-part criminal mischief section here, as opposed to the two-part one that we considered at the last meeting, we have third-degree mischief, which is tampering, which is, in essence, amounts to interfering with somebody else's property, and thereby inconveniencing him, whether or not you cause any damage to it. Number two, if you interfere with it and do cause damages that exceed $100 in its second degree, or if you intentionally damage the property without any right, regardless of what damage is, it's second degree, or if you recklessly, if you interfere with it, if you recklessly damage the property and it exceeds $100 in its second degree, right? And the third is that if the if you use explosives or if you cause damage in an amount exceeding $1,000, right? Now, with respect to that, is there any redundancy or ambiguity between Section 3, Sub 1, and Section 2, Sub 2A?
Two A and 2, of course, you need an intent. Intentional damage to the property. You need that in 3, in Section 3.
So you have the intent there.
Yeah, right. You still have to have the intent, but the amount of damage.
But there's no limit on the damage. There's no limit on the damage in 2A. And so, what if I were defending and they charged me with criminal mischief in the first degree? Pretending that the damage exceeded $1,000, and I say, look, unconstitutional. There's no limit on the damage in the other. You should have charged me under 2A.
You need to put in, and if the damage of less than $1,000, then 2A.
Well, all we're doing, it seems to me, Mr. Chairman, that the crime that's prohibited under Section 3 has one more element than the one under Section 2, and that's the element of value of the damage.
But you don't state it explicitly.
We don't explicitly state it nor place a level of value on 2A. Look, I want to agree with you, because I prefer to have it open-ended in 2A, but I can sure see a demur popping up.
I think you need to put the $1,000 limitation in 2A.
You think that would raise a perfect bill?
I think it would.
I can't say that it wouldn't. I don't know why it wouldn't.
I prefer it this way, but I just, it bothers me.
It can't be said it's implied then that 2A is for crimes under $1,000. Is
I doubt it can be implied.
You could be charged
with criminal mischief in the second degree, and the proof showed that it was worth $10,000.
That's right, and it proved conformed to the pleading.
Proof that it was a value of more than $1,000 wouldn't be a defense.
Well, of course, I was looking at it in terms of elements that I think that, for example, a petty larceny statute, you can say a man commits petty larceny if he steals property. Then you can have a statute that says he commits grand larceny if he steals property of a value of X number of dollars. And you're just adding an element to the crime, that's all.
Our old statute doesn't.
Yeah, but it's drawn in terms of penalties. I mean, that's the way our present statute reads.
What you're saying?
In other words, our larceny statute just says, it doesn't say petty larceny, grand larceny. It just says larceny, and then if the value of the property is more than $75, that's punishable.
Well, that's a cure, isn't it?
I don't think it's a, if the subcommittee feels that you'd be happier by including that in there and saying intentionally damages property of another in an amount not exceeding $1,000 or. I don't think it's. I'm not sure I agree that it's essential to be in there, but on the other hand, I think if it could have possibly avoid any problem of interpretation, that it ought to be in there. You think it ought to be in there?
I'm afraid I would react to some misunderstanding on this. That only by reading the two together, you explain what that one element is different between the two.
But in other words, say you went to trial, you charged a man with criminal mischief in the first degree, and he was indicted and he was charged with having intent to damage property and no reasonable right to believe that he had any right to do so, and he damaged the property of another in an amount exceeding $1,000. Then at trial, you weren't able to prove the damage. I think you could still convict him of second degree. Because you couldn't prove that element, but you could prove the elements that are set forth under second degree.
Be a lesser included. You'd be entitled to an instruction in any event. But assuming that we limited 2A by saying the amount not exceeding $1,000, you went to trial on an indictment for first degree, and there was no proof whatsoever with respect to value, then you could get a judgment of acquittal, didn't you?
If there was no
motion
proof of
time.
No
proof of value. No. Of damages. Yeah. No proof of amount of damage. What you're saying is that the way it is now, if you go and you charge him an indictment with $15,000 worth of damage and your proof fails to establish an exact dollar amount on the damage, then you could still get him on the lesser included.
Yeah.
But if the lesser included had a dollar figure on it, and you didn't get a dollar figure on the damages, again, then you couldn't even get him on the lesser included. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying that. No, I don't agree with that. I think you could still get him on the lesser included. I think the only place where you would be entitled to take it from the jury, if you were defending a man charged with first-degree criminal mischief, would be if there's no proof on value. I think if there is proof of an intent to damage and there's proof that the property was damaged, you would be entitled to go to a jury on that proof.
Under the way it is now. Yeah. But what if...
Or under the way you suggest. Right. I think that... I don't think that you would be required to prove that it was worth less than $1,000. I think if you're going to convict him of first degree, you'd have to prove it was worth more than $1,000. But if there is no proof, I think it'd be just the same as
well, in some damage, regardless of amount.
Just question. It's a question of fact.
Same way now. You charge a man with grand larceny, and you fail on your proof of value. He's not entitled to a judgment of acquittal. He may be entitled to a judgment of acquittal on that charge, but you'd be entitled to go to the jury on the question of petty larceny if you didn't have any proof of value in.
Well. I believe that theoretically I agree with you. Practically, I'm not sure that that's the interpretation.
In other words, I don't think that you would have to prove that the property was worth $35 or $40 or any other amount under $75. I think if you don't prove
value,
you're not entitled to a conviction on grand larceny.
But it's a question of fact for the jury to determine.
And I think it would be the same way here. Even if we included under second degree, if we included a phrase amount less than $1,000, I think you'd still be entitled to that, even though you didn't prove any value. I think you'd, because I don't think value is an element. Value is not an element of second degree any more than I think value is an element of petty larceny. I don't think value is an element of petty larceny. It becomes important when you get into grand larceny.
You're sure of that?
Well, I'm reasonably sure, yes.
By golly, the instructions that we used to give were wrong then, because we always listed value as an element versus petty grants. But,
and if you look at New York's draft on theft, for example, the way they their section on larceny, find it here real quick. Section 155.25 sets out a person is guilty of petty larceny when he steals property. Period. Nothing about value as an element. Then they get the only place where a value of the property becomes an element is in their statement of grand larceny in the third degree, second degree, and first degree. And it's in an ascending order of severity depending upon the value of the property. But with respect to petty larceny, element is that he steals property. And that's the only thing that you need to prove to convict him of petty larceny. And it would seem to me that if you indict him for any of the higher degrees or charge him under a complaint with any of the higher degrees of larceny, you charge him with grand larceny, and you prove everything but value, you would be entitled to a conviction of petty larceny.
All right. Okay. What's the wish of the subcommittee? I admit that I'm more confused than Adam with respect to this. I have no personal I would prefer to see it left the way it is, but I have a question in my mind. And what do you think, Bruce?
I would bet that the probability that there's no problem the way it is, but I don't feel certain.
Could I suggest this? Could we make a tentative approval of this if there are no other objections?
Well, I was going to ask, why is it necessary to repeat three times, having no right to do so, on reasonable grounds, believe that he has such a right? That's included in
1, 2, 3?
Third degree and second degree and first degree.
Well, no, because now under third degree, the intent that we're talking about there is not an intent to cause damage to property, but an intent to cause substantial inconvenience. That's under third degree.
Yes, but he has no right to do it, or reasonable ground to believe that he has such right in all of them. And then, in second degree, yes. If those elements are there, the only thing that's added is either that he intentionally damages it or recklessly damages it, and not $100. Third degree, the only thing that's added is that he is up to $1,000 or he uses explosives. There's nothing added.
You follow this, Kathleen, from a drafting standpoint?
Yes, I had somewhat the same question in my mind. I was thinking of the way you did it, you handled theft and handled the defenses. Separate sections, and we said it several, you know, various acts, one of them being a claim of right and so forth, is a defense to this charge. Now, I don't know whether that works it out the same way, or whether by including it when done has it becomes one of the elements, as opposed to being a defense, and I think this may change the focus somewhat.
No, I don't follow you. What becomes an element? Now, what do you mean?
Well, the showing that he had no right or reasonable grounds to believe, as opposed to being able to come in and say, look, I had reasonable grounds to believe that that property was such that I could...
That's a defense to any of them.
Right, yeah. But doesn't that change the focus a little bit as to whether it's a defense or whether it's really an original statement?
Yeah, my intent was that this was an element.
Well, that's what I finally became convinced of after I carefully bracketed it.
But it's an element of all three.
Yeah. Well, no, a variation of that is an element of all three, but it's not the same element in all three. Now, two and three, yeah, except for sub one of section two, because there we're talking about and having no right or reasonable ground to believe that he has a right to tamper or interfere with the property.
I've got it. Can I cut you off? Do it this way, just like our larceny statute. The second would be whatever it is, criminal mischief, be headed criminal mischief. Then it would read, a person who, with intent to cause substantial inconvenience to the owner, or to another, and having no right to do so, nor reasonable ground to believe that he has such right, (1) commits criminal mischief in the third degree if he tampers or interferes with the property of another, (2) commits criminal mischief in the second degree if he violates subsection 1 and as a result thereof damages property in an amount exceeding $100, and then
3 commits criminal mischief in the second degree if he intentionally damages property of another. 4 commits criminal mischief in the second degree if he recklessly damages property of another in an amount exceeding $1,000. 5 commits criminal mischief in the first degree if he damages property of another in an amount exceeding $1,000. 6 commits criminal mischief in the first degree if he damages property of another by means of explosive. Now that's basically what you're getting at, only there's a redundancy by me having 2 or 3 sections. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah.
Well, of course, you end up repeating your degrees several times.
Right, I do.
Of course, there's a problem.
Well, what's the problem with redundancy that you find here? What really is wrong with that? Redundancy.
Well,
I don't know.
Nothing is technically wrong with it, other than you're saying the same thing 3 times.
The only thing I was trying to do was to set out the elements in each section, and I think you could, you know, it's a question of approach, but I certainly wasn't intending that.
Well, I think
why this having a right or reasonable grounds was a defense. I don't mean that. I think
that's what I decided after
I think it should be an element. Yes,
well, since we have that in section 1, why do we need to say it again at all? Why couldn't we say the whole thing in section 2, a person commits a crime of criminal mischief in the second degree? If he violates section 1, he can't violate section 1 without it being proven that he had no right or reasonable ground to believe that he had such a right.
So go down to
A and B.
Well,
stick that to.
Well, no. No.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what I'm talking about now. Under section 1, we're talking about the right or the grounds to believe he has such a right. The right to do what? To tamper or interfere with the property. That's what I'm talking about. And if he does that, and with an intent to cause substantial inconvenience, and as a result of this, he damages property, and then he gets into criminal mischief in the second degree. But then when we get into 2, the right or reasonable ground to believe that he has such